News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us. Stay tuned. Labor Radio is next.
KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Did you catch the Bluegrass Marathon? If you enjoyed the programming, you can show your support for KBOO and music from the True Vine by purchasing a commemorative 2026 Bluegrass Marathon t-shirt. The t-shirt's graphic was brilliantly designed by KBOO volunteer and Bluegrass host Justin Ault. To check out the merch and catch the recording of the marathon, head over to kboo.fm/bluegrass.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Energy Trust of Oregon, empowering people throughout the region with energy-efficient solutions that can improve the comfort and safety of homes, businesses, and lives. More info at energytrust.org. Energy Trust of Oregon.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel. We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. I'm a public school teacher. I host every second Monday of the month. We typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today, we have Yahaira Quapio. Welcome, Yahaira.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad you could fill in for your comrade who came down ill. Would you start out by just telling listeners about what you do as an educator, where you work, what does your job entail?
Yeah. So I am a school social worker, so I am able to work in public schools. My credential is in people personnel services. And so as a school social worker, I've mostly been working in elementary schools. I lead a lot of systems at the school level. One of the main things is obviously coordinating the care for our students. Really all of the students in the public schools are my students. So I work with everyone. I run a lot of groups, social emotional learning groups, social skills group, therapy groups. I provide one-on-one counseling. Any sort of helping link families or students to outside services with community-based organizations, I do that as well. And facilitate a lot of meetings, a lot of teaming, trauma-informed practices. So it really ranges from like tier one to tier three supports, which for those of For people not familiar in school systems, that's
Yeah.
just how the different tier supports that and interventions we provide.
Right. And always like to hear what inspires folks to get into the work that they're doing. So what inspired you?
Yeah, this is a really great question. I really like it. So growing up, I think one of the biggest things that I really was profoundly touched by was the search for dignity for both my mom and my father. I was born and raised in Koreatown, Los Angeles. If you've ever visited, it's a melting pot of diversity. We have so many people there, not just from Mexico or Latin America, but also Korea. And yeah, I think one of the things that really struck me was my parents, they immigrated here very, very young, had me that same year. I was born in 1990. And their search for dignity and having talks with them and hearing about it at the dinner table really struck me. And I think I really began, that's where my consciousness really grew, asking myself why different people were treated differently. So in middle and high school, I actually took a school bus to go to attend a public school outside of Koreatown. And I noticed that there was a big difference in the types of resources that the schools had available. I was bused to the San Fernando Valley. And, that out of that, I really wanted to understand how does change happen? And so I, thought that by working really, really hard and going to college that I was going to figure that out. And to some extent, it helped. But I became a double major in women's and gender studies and also psychology, and started working at a shelter for runaway youth in Riverside, California. And it was actually through that job that I noticed that so many of the students there had been ignored and were in special education, had IEPs, but had already dropped out of school, were in the juvenile justice system, and many came from families that looked exactly like mine. And so that really inspired me to want to be in public education, ideally in elementary schools. And that's exactly what I did. So that's how I ended up here.
And can you also talk about your union involvement? Talk about how you first started getting involved in your union and some of your experiences, as well as the positions that you hold now.
So I moved to the Bay Area in 2015 to work with a mental health agency. Since I was working at a residential like setting previously, and I was doing that while I was getting my master's in social work. And when I was working with the nonprofit, I noticed that I did not have the same working conditions as my colleagues did, even though we were doing the exact same, very similar work. Anytime they had spring break, I was not on break. I still had to work. I worked year round, and I was really worried about burning out. And so when I was getting my master's degree, I decided to get my credential as well. So as soon as I joined and was hired by SFUSD, I said, I want to be a union member, sign me up. And that same year, I was at a school, Visitation Valley Elementary School, and that same year, we were actually running a survey to ask our members if we were to, create a statewide coordinated campaign, what would be your top demands? And so I really, and I say that just because hopefully we can talk about the We Can't Wait campaign later, but I really came into UESF at a time where we were really looking to shift the culture in the union, to be more of an organizing, fighting union. And I was coming very hungry. Like I said earlier, from a very young age, I wanted to learn how do we change society, right? And I thought that I was going to gain all those skills in academic settings. And, I didn't know it then, but I actually was going to learn it in the field. And coming to work for SFUSD was that starting point for me.
Great. Great story. Well, we did invite you on the show because you all went on strike in February. But before we get to the strike, just tell us some about the San Francisco community and schools. Of course, I think a lot of folks know that it's there's a certain amount of there are affordability issues, maybe I would put it that way. the tech industry, I think, has had a huge impact on the community. But what else can you tell us about the community and what's it like working there? And how do you afford to live in San Francisco?
So, hopefully, if most people don't know, San Francisco is a beautiful place to live in. We have amazing parks. It's a 7 by 7 mile radius city, so it's really small, but there's traffic if you want to get across the city. And it takes more than 30 minutes sometimes. But I think another thing I'll say, it's very diverse. There's so much rich culture, art, food, a lot of young people, a lot of families, even though I think San Francisco gets a rep that we don't have enough families. There are a lot of, people that live together and are chosen families as well. I think that's something that sticks out about San Francisco. But in terms of the material conditions, I think if you go to any neighborhood and you go to their public schools, you will see which schools have resources and which schools do not have resources. One of the neighborhoods where I go out to support the most is in the southeast side of San Francisco, and that's where we have neighborhoods like the Bayview, Visitation Valley, the Excelsior neighborhoods. That are really, that's where you see a lot of the Chinese working class in San Francisco, the Black working class in San Francisco. And I will say that, we in UESF make it an intention to ensure that we're always advocating for resources and schools, not just in those neighborhoods, but across our school districts. Because we really don't think that based on the zip code that you go to school should define the level of, academic outcomes for you. I think another thing that is really stark and important to say is that, this right-wing shift that we saw it, after Trump's second election, we witnessed it here too and experienced it in San Francisco. We have a mayor, Daniel Lurie, who's an heir to the Levi, family, and some of the policies and that his campaign ran on were really actually pinning working class families against each other, blaming that the increase in crime was due to progressive policies, for example. And we're seeing an austerity narrative, right? That the city budget needs to make huge layoffs to city workers, and that we need to cut funding to services. So the contradictions are definitely, we feel them here in San Francisco. So,
The austerity narrative seems to be growing by the day. It's definitely big up here in Oregon. Well, let's shift to the bargaining process and how you got started. Talk about the big issues that you were hoping to address going into bargaining.
This is my favorite part. So, as part of my role in UESF, I was one of the bargaining co-chairs, and like I mentioned earlier, or maybe I didn't, but I've been on the executive board for 5 years now, going on to my 6th year. One of our top two biggest priorities was common good demands, which one of them was seeking sanctuary school policies. Especially since the second Trump administration, we have seen an increase, obviously, in ICE terror, not just in California, but across the country, I'm sure, and especially in Oregon, like you're familiar with this as well. So this was something that we wanted to ensure that, San Francisco says that they're a sanctuary city. Like, we want to see this reflected in our working conditions as well and in our district. And this proposal about sanctuary schools, we actually passed it across the table several times, and the district management team rejected it multiple times, saying that it did not belong in the contract. The other one, a top priority, was on shelter. We wanted a commitment to continue to expand the stayover program that we have here in our district, which is a shelter just for SFUSD students and families. And so we really wanted to, the district to show us, like, if you want to collaborate with us, you need to commit to this. The other one, really, really important, was to improve the special education workload conditions, working conditions too, of our educators and our students. That is where we have seen the most vacancies. It has been really challenging when, an RSP, a resource specialist, does not have support and does not have a paraeducator in their classroom to support their students, the caseloads, the supports and interventions, then it makes the working conditions extremely hard. And then the other two, where obviously we wanted to decrease the educator wage gap in San Francisco. It's things are really expensive here. It's also in the Bay Area. And then finally, for healthcare, this is so important. We wanted to, when we got it, but we were really fighting for our employer to fully fund healthcare benefits for our dependents.
Yes. Okay. All right. Sounds pretty ambitious. So take us through the bargaining process. What sort of I understand you were on the bargaining team, so you had your unique perspective being on the inside. Some of my wonderings are more about what was going on outside, but if you can talk to both. What sorts of actions did you do to keep your members engaged and to ramp up pressure on the district?
Now, well, I love talking about the bargaining process because I think, sometimes for folks listening, sometimes bargaining can feel very just technical, legal terms, administrative. But in UESF, we really try to embrace a model that we call bargainizing. We did not invent that model by any means, but we definitely embrace it. And really, what that means is that every single person in the bargaining team is responsible to be the organizer as well. And so the ex we started the entire bargaining team process with unifying around our strategy, unifying around core demands, and also ensuring that there was a process that would ensure that anyone that disagreed, that they would be encouraged to passionately debate us, and that, whatever decision we came at the table on the floor, that would be the message that we would, share out with the membership. So I would say that that process, I think, really taught us how to be disciplined, how to have, how to be leaders at our work sites. So we represent over 6,000 members, all different types of roles, school librarians, nurses, social workers, counselors, So, doing that process, I think, really united us in that way. And then on the field, we had UESF had really identified core leaders at almost all of our sites. At least 6 years ago, maybe we had leadership representation at each work site, maybe about like 30%, and now we're nearly 100%, So, so everyone knew what was happening with the bargaining team. After every single session that we had, information went up on our social media, an email was sent out, and bargaining team members were expected to present to their sites exactly what was happening. And I think that alone is really what brought the membership in and really engaged them through the process. The other thing too is, we escalated, we had tactics, we had petitions. We were not hiding at any point. We were never hiding anything from the district. We were always really visible. Like, these are our strike ready petitions. We had practice pickets last school year at sites, and then earlier this year we had site strike pickets. So at every point we were escalating. We were going to the Board of Education meetings. We were presenting our petitions. We were doing speak outs. We were doing rallies, we were doing interviews, we held a strike conference. So, I will say that both the bargaining and the organizing in the field was very, very like tied together, and every single member was expected to be out in the streets as well as in the, inside the bargaining room.
And how did you all get to the point where you decided to call for a strike?
Yeah, so we our union is very unique in that our bylaws, we need to have two strike votes. The first vote is to just authorize the president to hold the strike vote, and then the second vote is the actual strike vote. Yeah, so in the last big bargaining that we had, which was in 2024. That was the first time that we experimented with a really big bargaining team. It's what we call it, the big bargaining team. And the results of that first strike authorization vote was huge, because the very next bargaining session, the district said everything that they told us they didn't have, they suddenly had to fund it. And
Oh, interesting.
yeah. And so, it was a viable threat. And at that point, we were like, okay, well, we did get big historic raises. One of them for our classified members was bringing the floor up to $30 an hour. Which was huge, and we also had raises for certificated. But anyway, that process taught us a lot. I mean, it's important that as organizers, that we learn and consolidate all those lessons and bring it into the next one. So we learned a lot. That day, the strike vote was long. People waited for hours, but it told us so much of where our membership was at in terms of they were willing to wait for hours to cast their vote. So, fast forward to this time around, when we had the strike vote, we improved the logistics of that, because we were saying we need to get this right. Like, in order to run a very successful strike where everything is organized, where workers are militant, everyone knows where to go, we need to ensure that every single event, organization, any display of protest that we ever have is organized, right? And so the strike vote was exactly that. Our members were able to come and go. And so when we saw the energy and the commitment to do this again, even after maybe being traumatized the first time from standing in line, I think that told us a lot of obviously where we were at. We had structure tests for everything. We always looked at the data, we looked at the numbers. And when I say we, I don't just mean the bargaining team, I mean the executive board of our union as well, right? We asked ourselves the hard questions, like, okay, where are our strengths, but where are our gaps, and why aren't we getting the numbers that we want to see yet? So we analyzed a lot of data, and the data really told us our membership is coming along with us. And also, what was happening at the bargaining table, like, the district was telling us no. They were saying that we could get a 2% raise with concessions, like funding in out of the things in our own contract. They were saying absolutely no to shelter and sanctuary. And in terms of healthcare, that was it. They were saying absolutely not. We just, we austerity, we just don't have the funds. And all of that was contradicting all our research. And so I think the other part is when you see working class people just coming, like regular people like you and I, just coming together and strategizing and doing the research and finding the money for them. Like, we can't let, like, we have to push forward. We unlocked so much creativity, so much motivation. And it was, yeah. And so, after each tactic and after looking at the data, it was evident that our membership was really the one that was pushing us to make the right decision and the right call.
Gotcha. Okay. Wow. Hey, we only have a few minutes left, and I still have a number of questions. So let's get to it. So just talk briefly, maybe then, about the strike. You were on strike for 4 days, I think. Tell us about some of the highs and lows, and I'm also curious about how the community responded.
Okay, this is great. I love this. So I was in the bargaining room almost the entire time, right? And so I didn't really get to see the field, but I will say, I seen all the media that was coming out, knowing that we had a very tight organization in terms of which officers and which UESF staff members were supporting the field. Everything. I think the organizational strength of UESF was on full display for the whole city to see at that point, and the country, honestly. I was getting text messages from friends out of state telling me this. So yeah, I mean, the energy in the room was really high, because almost everyone else, except for me, as one of the, lead negotiators, I had to be in the room preparing. So they all were actually at their site pickets in the morning, and then they would come back super motivated. We saw an increase in how community members by day three. I think one of the biggest things that I really want to highlight and emphasize was on day three of the strike, there were some high school students that held a press conference outside of where the war memorial where we were holding our bargaining session.
Yeah,
And
nice.
then they came up and wanted to speak to our superintendent, Maria Sue. And she was not present, but she did send a representative in her place to listen to students. And for the students, what became very clear for all of us in the bargaining team of why we needed to push and say, we're not going to accept crumbs. We're actually not ending this strike until you give us everything, was because our students shared their stories of how they had parents that were special education educators, how they had siblings who were teachers in our public schools. And for them, it was a double hit. This now we weren't just talking about their learning conditions. We were actually talking about their living conditions at home and how seeing their family struggle to work here was impacting them at home. And I'm getting a little emotional just talking about it because this is why we do it, right? We do it for our students, but we do it for families, for working class families who want a better future, who deserve that. And it was an important lesson to show the students that we're listening to you. We're in solidarity with you, even though they were showing up for us. I think it lit a fire in us that day, you know. So on day three, we went hard. On day four, we came back even harder. And I think that was a big thing. And obviously seeing all the coworkers and the bargaining team was able to go out, I think on day two to the field, and everyone was stopping by to hug us and kiss us and shower us with love and support to keep going, keep going. And so seeing that optimism, I obviously really pushed us too.
And then real quickly, what did you end up winning?
Yes, okay. So earlier when I talked about those demands, so we did get fully funded healthcare. By July 2026, all members will on the dependents will see like cuts by half, but then by January 2027, the district will be paying at 100%. We saw wage increases for both classified and certificated. We saw improved working conditions for special education. We have some compliance periods to support special education and all the case management, IEP writing, IEP meeting, testing that they have to do. And we got the common good language for shelters and also sanctuary school policies.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. So what do you think you learned from all of this? Obviously, you already had some experience, but how do you think you grew as a union leader? And
Yeah.
also any impact on other members as well that you've noticed?
Yeah, I mean, the strike has really shifted the culture in us. When I came back from the strike, my coworkers were saying that this was almost like the best community builder activity that we could have done. They were saying that they came back changed, and we were able to learn from each other and learn about each other in new ways than before. I will say my biggest lesson, because I've been reflecting a lot on this, is actually how when we came to the strike victory in that moment, it felt like, I think for many people, it was a moment in time, right? And the victory maybe might have felt sudden. But I was really deeply, impacted by the fact that, okay, this actually took years to build up to this, right? And we had to make big shifts in the organization to turn it into an organizing model, to identify leaders that wouldn't just move a couple of their coworkers, but a super majority, right? I was reminded by all the one-on-one conversations, by not really knowing that I was going to become a leader in this when I first started, working here. All I said was, I want to learn how society changes, and I am enthusiastic and I want to learn how to organize. And so I think for me, the culmination of the strike is that we build up to this moment, right? The first strike, I like to say this, that in the first big bargaining, we were learning who we were and we were learning about our power. In this last victory, we learned that we actually can take back power and and that we have power. And now there's no going back. We have to increase it. We have to sustain it. So that's, I think, the next political question for us. And We became a force in San Francisco politics.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time, and I was really hoping to talk with you a little bit about the We Can't Wait campaign, but maybe we'll get you to come back and talk some about that, because that's a really exciting sort of statewide coordinating campaign that I'm excited to learn more about. But thank you so much, Yehuda, for joining us today on KBOO. I want to thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. This is Steven Siegel. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 o'clock to catch another Labor Radio show.
Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Hi, this is Melissa Lesniak, the creator and host of That Vegan Show. On That Vegan Show, you will hear in-depth guest interviews on vegan-related